Hello, and welcome to Radio New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. In a moment, progressive people will start dropping into our airwaves. They will be bringing us stories and experiences that are truly tantalising, from the wonderful world of dark, sweet, smooth, luscious chocolate. Where it comes from, why it enhances our health, and who profits from it. I'm Chris Richards, and I'm joined today by my friend and colleague Troth Wells, who, like me, is an editor for New Internationalist Publications. Troth's co-written a fabulous book all about chocolate, The Best Job in Town, as it's meant, amongst other things, that Troth's been testing out a whole range of chocolate recipes. And before we start getting into some serious stories about how chocolate is made, let's start with something to tantalise our taste buds. What's on the main meal menu today, Troth?
Okay, well, I had quite a job trying to find something out of the range of lovely dishes in this book. And of course, as you would think, chocolate is mostly used in sweet dishes and desserts. So the book has many of those in it. But I have come up with some nice recipes, mainly from Latin America, because that's where chocolate is used in savoury dishes. And the one I've picked out is chicken chocolate mole. And mole is the sauce that goes with the chicken. Cocoa was used by the Aztecs originally, and they never added sugar to it. But the word mole comes from a Mexican Indian word meaning concoction and applies to a variety of sauces that are particularly good with chicken and turkey. Turkey, the bird, actually is indigenous to that region, Central America, and it came from there to Europe and other parts of the world, probably via merchants from the Middle East, hence the name Turkey.
Is that right?
So this dish is... Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it?
Wow, yeah. I mean, because I didn't know actually chocolate came from Latin America either. So chocolate and turkey, please go on.
And in fact, in French, they call turkey dand, which means from India. So, you know, all over Europe, they had different conceptions of where it came from. Anyway, for this dish, you can either use chicken or turkey, but I'm going to use chicken. And you take some chicken breasts and you just put them in some water with enough to cover and just boil for a little bit till they're tender and take them out and keep the juice. And then you make this fantastic sauce, which is onions, garlic, peppercorns, cloves, tomato sauce, the stock, bread, star anise. I don't know if you know that. That's star-shaped with a lovely flavour.
Aniseed kind of flavour, yeah?
That's right, yeah. And it looks fantastic too on the dish. And then you add some chilli and sesame seeds and pine nuts. You simmer all that together very gently and then blend it nice and smooth. And then the chocolate that comes in next. You stir that in to melt. And the chocolate I tend to use is something I can buy over the internet called Ibarra. That's Ibarra, which is the Mexican chocolate. I think you can probably get it in some specialist shops as well. But cooking chocolate would do fine. And then you put the chicken breasts into the sauce and simmer it gently and serve it with rice or potatoes or noodles even. Fantastic.
That was one of your personal favourites, Troth?
It certainly was, and I tested it out, as we do with family, and that got a definite thumbs up. I think, you know, it's quite a strange combination for us sometimes,
Absolutely.
The idea of eating a chocolate-flavoured dish with meat, but it goes really well, and you can do all sorts of things. You can do chili con carne or chili sin carne if you're a vegetarian, using chocolate, and the chocolate and chili combination is actually quite... fascinating as well. It's very, very good.
Yes, the thing that surprises me about your recipes, Troth, is that you can improve savoury dishes by adding some sweetness. All kinds of dishes.
Yes, just, that's true, isn't it?
You've just described chicken, but there's meat and there's beans. What do you personally put that down to, having tested a number of them yourself now?
Probably because the sweetness sort of brings out the flavours of the meat, doesn't it? I'm thinking particularly of Middle Eastern or Cape cooking from South Africa, which uses very similar spicing to Middle East, coming from the Malay slaves, as they were called originally, which is using sultanas or apricots, you know, using sweet fruits and cooking them with the meat, dates, figs even. And they somehow just impart a richness that actually brings out the flavour of the meat in some way. It is amazing, but it does work, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Chocolate was born in Latin America, as you explained, and many of the savoury dishes in your book have a Latino base. Do other countries' cuisines dip into chocolate?
I've not really found many using meat or savoury dishes. I'll probably be told of hundreds and thousands now by your listeners, but probably that's because chocolate doesn't travel that well. I mean, when I lived in Malaysia, although they grow cocoa there, they don't really eat chocolate there. It's the same in West Africa, where cocoa is also grown. And of course, one of the problems there is that they're not really allowed or haven't been allowed to manufacture chocolate themselves in the past. And therefore, they're buying chocolate from England or from America, and it comes in tins in order to keep it good, because of the very damp heat can make chocolate go off quickly. So possibly the fact that it wasn't manufactured there meant that it didn't really get used in local dishes. Mm-hmm. But it's a good question.
Mm. The 16th century Aztec emperor Montezuma was reputed to believe that chocolate was an aphrodisiac. In our era, Italian researchers say women who regularly eat chocolate have a better sex life. No reports yet on what it does for men. Nikki van der Garg researched the effects that chocolate has on our bodies and souls. Is there any basis for this claim that chocolate helps your sex life, Nikki?
Well, difficult to prove it, but it's very interesting that the rumours about the fact that it does go back as far as Montezuma, and they've certainly kind of surfaced at various other stages through the ages. And there has been a general belief that chocolate and sex are in some way linked. Sometimes for obvious reasons, I guess, that chocolate tastes good. But also there is some scientific evidence that chocolate is a very complex substance. I think it contains over more than 300 chemical substances, including theobromine, which affects the nervous system and increases alertness and concentration. Andamide, which is a bit like the active ingredient in cannabis, which may explain why we crave it, and a substance which, similar to the body's own dopamine, that's what's given to Parkinson's patients to stimulate their nervous system, so it can have mood-altering effects. So all those things taken together, you can see why people might think, well, yeah, it's an aphrodisiac.
Interesting. And so what actually does it do to your body? I mean, dopamine is something that I suppose makes us smile. What's the actual effects on our psychology and physiology?
Nobody quite knows. I mean, there have been some experiments done looking at the way that it kind of stimulates the nervous system and makes your adrenaline go. Often chocolate has caffeine in it as well, so it would have similar effects to drinking a very strong cup of coffee. But people have also said that it's a nourishing thing. It's got iron in it, it's got protein in it, it's got calcium in it. Nutritional content obviously varies according to the chocolate that you're eating, but it has a lot of good things in it as well. One of the things I found really interesting was doing research on it and finding out just what a complex food it is. And also apparently that chocolate has over 400 distinct smells within it, and something like a rose has only 14 and an onion only has 6 or 7. So it's a very complicated substance, and I had no idea of that when I started out doing the research. I thought that was very interesting.
And what's the difference between milk chocolate and dark chocolate?
Well, it's got milk in it and dark chocolate hasn't, but dark chocolate generally is more pure cocoa and therefore is supposed to be better for you because it doesn't have so much sugar and it doesn't have the milk. It's actually more what you'd call pure chocolate. Although chocolate as we have it now is something that's fairly recent. The original people who were drinking cocoa were drinking something very different. Originally, when they first started taking chocolate, it didn't, for example, have it with sugar, so it wasn't a sweet substance. There was an interesting report, for example, when chocolate first came to Britain in the 1800s, where one report described the chocolate served to British soldiers. It was a drink rather than a bar, and they called it as thick as soup and as greasy as a fish fryer's thumb. So they obviously didn't like it very much.
And what about that connection between dark chocolate and, they say, cancer?
I must admit, I'm slightly sceptical in the sense that for every study you hear saying chocolate or wine or whatever helps prevent heart disease or cancer, you'll find another one that says it doesn't.
So what, in your reading, were the range of conditions chocolate's supposed to help combat, Nikki?
I'm not sure there are that many specific things. I mean, through history, there have been some really interesting studies that say that chocolate can help liver problems, it can help consumption, i.e. your lungs, It can help fever and muscle diseases, hypochondria, no idea why, and hemorrhoids. There was a book written by a Mayan priest in the 1500s which said that if you had skin eruptions, fever and seizures, you should have a bowl of chocolate containing two peppers, honey and tobacco juice, and that would cure you. The other things down the ages that it's been known to help is injured feet, liver problems, being used as a laxative. In 1719, there was a Frenchman who recommended chocolate for exhausted spirits and said that an ounce of chocolate contains as much nourishment as a pound of beef. But he did warn against its use by fat people.
Yes, and that obesity is one of the downsides, isn't it?
You know, you couldn't blame obesity on chocolate. Obesity is caused mainly by overeating, and chocolate does contain a lot of kilojoules for its weight, and it can contribute to this, but it obviously depends how much chocolate you eat. Switzerland, for example, has one of the lowest incidences of obesity and coronary heart disease in Western Europe, and they eat the most chocolate. They eat 22 pounds a year.
There are other things chocolate's thought to affect in a less than positive way too, things like acne, even migraines.
I think the migraine thing, the research has shown that although on its own it's unlikely to cause migraines, there are some people who say in a particularly hormonal state or stress state, it can act as a trigger. I think oranges is also something that can act as a trigger for a migraine. And people who get migraines regularly often do avoid chocolate because they know that there's a connection there. And acne and pimples is mainly about the sugar, really. Obviously, if you eat a lot of chocolate, so a lot of refined carbohydrates like sugar and white flour, it might well give you spots, but again, not on its own.
That was Nikki van der Garg, co-author of the book that we've featured today, The Bittersweet World of Chocolate, published by New Internationalist magazine. You can find out more about the book on the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. You're a champion. Nikki, thank you very much for being part of the program today.
Thanks very much, Chris.
Bye for now.
Bye.
You're listening to Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia, chatting with Troth Wells, who's sitting in Oxford in England, about the book that she's co-written, The Wonderful and Not So Wonderful World of Chocolate. Troth's been cooking up some fabulous dishes, starring the one, the only, chocolate. Tempt us with another recipe, Troth. What's your favourite cake mix?
Well, one I've chosen from cakes, again, quite a difficult selection, but I thought it'd be good to do something a little bit different. So I've selected the chocolate pumpkin spice cake because it's good to have more ways to use pumpkin. This particular one is seasoned with fragrant cinnamon, ginger, cloves and nutmeg. And plus it's got nuts and sultanas to give a great rich flavour with the chocolate. So I'm very fond of that one. Also with a cake like that, any chocolate cake, it's sometimes nice to serve it with some fruit. I don't know if you've ever done that. With some raspberries or strawberries or kiwi fruit. Looks lovely.
Yes, it would too. I suppose like so many products in our life, chocolate is sold in the rich world from produce that's made in the poor world. I was interested to see that as the middle classes in China and India are growing, so too are the sales of chocolate. Chocolate sales in China have tripled in the last 10 years, and its candy market is now a whopping $4.3 billion. And chocolate advertising in India increased by over 20% in the year 2004 alone, as more and more could afford to spend money on sweets. But what about in cooking, Troth? Is chocolate cake a creature of the rich world, or do other countries also use it to sweeten their lives?
I think among middle classes across the world, chocolate cake has a special standing, doesn't it? It's the ultimate rich treat cake that you have for birthdays or for celebrations of any sort. Again, going back to my experience in Malaysia, which is now well over 20 years ago, it was not hard to find a chocolate cake to buy for my son's birthday when we were living there.
Really?
Yeah, all the cake shops had chocolate cake. Now, I don't know if that would be true in Kenya, for example, or Senegal, but I wouldn't be surprised, let's put it like that. I think if you went to a good cake shop in the middle of town, you'd probably find chocolate cake somewhere there.
Now that's interesting, because while chocolate originates in Latin America, 95% of the cocoa beans making up chocolate are now grown in Africa. And while chocolate advertising may now say serenity, sex, satisfaction and sunshine, 70 years ago racism starred. Tell us about some of the posters you've dug up from advertising archives, Troth.
Well, I'm fascinated by chocolate advertising because, as you say, it has a very strong place in people's lives because everybody seems to relate to chocolate. And the ads are often subtly sexual. You might remember the gallant man in black who leapt from a moving train. Well, I don't know if you had those ads there. They certainly were on British TV. He jumped from a helicopter. He dangled from a cable car and plunged from a speedboat, all because the lady loves milk tray. And this was a series of adverts that, you know, combined this romantic, dark stranger with the fact that the woman loved her chocolate. And the sense of chocolate's enduring appeal is there in a 2002 Hershey's, that's the American chocolate company, advert, which said, although your girlfriend might leave you, chocolate never will. As we know, it's a security food too, isn't it? When
always
people are down
so, yes.
or depressed, they eat chocolate. And somehow that rich mouthfeel, they call it, actually adds to the experience and makes it a very sensuous and a very personal and a very gratifying thing to eat. But just leaving the politics aside for a second, there are some really beautiful artistic posters and adverts for chocolate. There are early ones from Bourneville, which show the actual Bourneville town that was laid out for the workers. There was the Fry's Five Boys advert that showed little five boys with different stages of anticipation as they waited for their chocolate. Mm. And then there are the artistic ones by Karl Moos, who's a Swiss painter, I think. And he did one called Chocolate Krauser, which had an amazing background of red sky with a vivid mountain standing in front of it and a cow on the mountain. You know, so it engenders all these wonderful images of relaxation, of beauty, of feeling good, and just an extraordinary range of experiences. But real advertising dates back to at least the 19th century and often reflected the colonial past. And there's an extraordinary series of Suchard chocolate adverts, which has a white guy as the star, sort of dressed in his colonial gear with his topi and his leggings, in different settings. In one, he's surrounded by Native Americans, and in another, he has black servants. One time, he's lounging in a canoe, which is paddled by Africans, a true colonial adventure with the quest for chocolate.
The thing that amazed me about those posters is that they're 1930s posters, but clearly that whole notion of white domination is a selling point. It's about a colonial white person with a hard hat going into half-naked black people and usurping their land and resources and also their bodies by chocolate production. And that's somehow supposed to sell.
Well, I think the selling point was really, I mean, these date from the early 20th century. I think it was about the quest and the adventure of bringing back whatever it was. I mean, in this case, they're advertising chocolate, but I think they're very similar to ones I've seen for tea and other products that came from, quote, exotic parts of the world and were brought back. It was all part of that extraordinary adventure of conquer and conquest, derring do and adventure and the foreign legion. You know, it had all those connotations as well. It wasn't seen in the way that we so clearly and obviously see it now as extremely racist and totally unacceptable.
So the transition is that guy jumping out of the plane or dangling from the long piece of string in a death-defying kind of act. That's the transition then. Still
that's
adventure.
The transition.
Ah.
He's doing it here, isn't he? He's not going off to the other side of the world to do it. I think that is exactly a good point. Yeah, I'd agree with that.
And in Africa, chocolate still has that very dark side. Slave labour continues to be poured into the mix.
Yes, unfortunately, there is a lot of child labour, in particular in Côte d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, which is the biggest producer of cocoa. And there is, sadly, a lot of trafficking from the neighbouring countries of Burkina Faso on the one hand and Mali on the other. And sometimes these children are taken and told that they're going to get a job in the city. You know, it's the usual story. We hear a lot about trafficking of sex workers. It's the same sort of story. They're told that they're going to get a job somewhere, get a better life, so on. And then they end up in these virtual slavery conditions. And that's been the case in some parts of West Africa, where children are working on the cocoa plantations, picking the cocoa pods and then opening them up and drying out the beans and then getting them ready for export.
Well, Côte d'Ivoire, or the Ivory Coast in West Africa, which is the country that Troth's just been talking about, is the world's largest cocoa producer, providing over 40% of the world's cocoa. A year 2000 report by the United States State Department estimated that approximately 15,000 children aged between the ages of 9 to 12 have been sold into forced labour on cotton, coffee and cocoa plantations in the north of that country. And that's only the start of the problem. Another report, in August 2002, estimated that 284,000 children were working on cocoa farms, doing dangerous deeds such as using machetes and applying pesticides without the proper protective gear. The International Labour Rights Forum, based in Washington, is one of the organisations working to address this problem. Bama Athreya is its executive director. Bama, one of the key ways you're recommending to combat this issue is for big chocolate manufacturers around the world to only buy their cocoa from a source that guarantees that there's no forced labour used in their produce. It sounds sensible. What's been the reaction?
It's been about 6 years now that we've been asking for the very fundamental step of the big chocolate companies getting some transparency into the supply chain. Know where your cocoa comes from, know where the farms are, and thereby you can figure out whether or not the farms are guilty of any abuses of human rights and the forced labor of children. And we've been shocked at the extent to which the large chocolate retailers and cocoa purveyors have completely failed to do this for going on 7 years now. They really have been allergic to taking the very first fundamental steps that you'd think they would want to take if they really want to make sure that their chocolate is child labor free.
Let's name some names here. Mama, is that a useful thing to do at this stage? I'd like to...
Oh, I think so. I think it's a fine thing to do. Let's talk a little bit about Ivory Coast and the cocoa supply so that all of your listeners know just how important it is to the world's chocolate industry. Ivory Coast, for many, many years now, has produced very nearly half the world's cocoa beans. They produce something like 40% of the world's cocoa supply, a little more than that if we're talking about the U.S. cocoa supply. No other country comes close. The next biggest producer of cocoa is Ghana, with about 20% of the world's market in cocoa beans. So you can see that Ivory Coast is very important indeed to chocolate. The interesting thing, once we start naming names, is that we find that there are a very small handful of companies that control virtually all of that cocoa trade from Ivory Coast. So we're not talking about very complicated supply chains. We can name three companies: Nestle Corporation, which most people in the world have heard of, and then two that are a little less well known, Archer Daniels Midland and Cargill, which are both very big commodity purveyors. They trade in all sorts of raw agricultural products. And between the three of them, I'd say they control about half of Ivory Coast's cocoa trade. And then behind them, there are about 9 or 10 other major exporting companies, and between them, we've got all of Ivory Coast's cocoa trade. The chocolate manufacturers, we can start to name some names that are a little more familiar to your average household: M&M Mars, Nestle, Hershey, Cadbury. These are the retailers. They all have to buy their beans from the same purveyors. So it's very easy to work your way back, you know, and figure out who's got control over the cocoa. So even if your favorite chocolate retailer may not be a name that I've just named, you just have to ask the one question: where do you get your cocoa from? And you're pretty sure to hit upon one of the companies that I've just named. They have spent many years now failing to respond to our basic questions. Their response has been along the lines of, oh, it's too difficult. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of farms. How could we possibly do it? But we're talking about a multi-billion dollar trade. I'm not familiar with the world data, but the U.S. chocolate market is worth about $16 billion a year. So, you know, it's a very enormous trade that's controlled by a fairly small handful of companies. But for 6 years now, they've been claiming it's just too tough for them. They can get the cocoa beans off the farms, but it's just too tough for them to go backwards and identify those farms. Just in the past few weeks, as a result of years of campaigning on this now, are the very first steps toward agreeing to certification. Not through fair trade. None of these big guys have agreed to fair trade yet. We know fair trade can be done because a number of smaller companies such as Divine and Equal Exchange have been doing it for years and years. but none of the big ones have agreed to fair trade as of yet.
Now, as I understand it, Cargill's you've had some success with.
We've seen Cargill take this little baby step, which is quite significant given that they've told us for 6 years now, and told all the campaigners for 6 years now, that they couldn't possibly get to the farms, right? They couldn't possibly certify at the farm level. And they've just announced a new initiative with UTZ certified, which is, it's not fair trade, but it is a certification system. We have no quarrel with it as a certification system. And with Oxfam Novib Netherlands. And they're saying that they will work with UTZ and Oxfam Novib to certify their farms in Ivory Coast. So this is the first time they've ever admitted they could certify the farms. There are some issues with the standards to which the farms will be certified. We don't think the child labor standards are strong enough, but we decided it would be very strategic to congratulate them for certifying at the farm level. Now, we'll see what happens next. They haven't done it yet, so I don't want to give them too much credit in public, but we are hoping by virtue of the fact that, you know, we as campaigners are willing to say this is great, go further than this, that they will actually now implement that promise.
Of course, it's all about money. If the chocolate industry paid a fair price for its cocoa, farmers would be in a better position to pay their workers fair wages. What do the big chocolate companies say about that, Barma?
We've pointed out to them that the increase in retail, the value of the cocoa in a chocolate bar, if you were taking, say, a Nestle Crunch bar, which is a popular item, and you changed all the cocoa in that chocolate bar to fair trade cocoa, the actual increase in price would be 0.02 cents.
You're joking.
That's all. That's all it would take. And yet, you know, I don't know what goes on in the boardrooms of these companies. They can do the math just as well as we can. But somehow when the decisions have to be made, the calculation is that it's not worth it. It is better to tolerate forced slavery in chocolate supply, in cocoa supply, than to pay that 0.02 cents per bar to clean it up. We'd like to be very rosy-eyed in our views of the benevolence of global corporations, but I look at figures like this and I think it would cost them so little, really, so little, to do this right and to ensure that human rights were taken care of in their supply chains and also to ensure that farmers were taken care of. My staff have traveled to Ivory Coast many times now. We've interviewed farmers. We've had heartbreaking stories from farmers of the incredible poverty in which they live. They are, in a way, tied to their cocoa trees. Trees take a long time to grow, and it's a big investment to grow them. And once you own your land and your trees, that's the only capital you have. So they grow the beans, and they sell them year after year, but they make barely enough to survive. There have been some years, in recent years, they haven't even made enough back to justify the cost of growing the cocoa bean. But they have to keep doing it. They have to keep hoping for a better year next year. And it would take so little, really, to solve this problem for farmers as well. But as you have just pointed out, what would companies have to give up to do it, apart from a little bit of money? They'd have to give up that control that they have, because knowledge is power, as they say, and the more transparent their supply chains are and the easier it is for someone like me or you to know exactly what goes on at the farm level, the more accountable those companies will be year after year. It won't just be their benevolence we count on anymore. We'll be able to hold them accountable, and I think that's their long-term fear.
Because there's another dimension to this, isn't there? A public interest dimension over and above fair trade and labour practices. If these kids are bonded to farms, they won't be getting an education, which diminishes their potential to help their country climb out of poverty. This seems so short-sighted of Africa, Barma. What reaction are you getting from the government of the Ivory Coast?
It's a problematic situation with the government. On the bigger point, I will say this has been our position for many years, that child labour is long-term problem, the problem for the future as well as the present, that you have got to invest in children and in children's education if you want to see countries develop. And we've had, you know, many an argument with economists, development economists, who seem to feel that the economic growth has to come first and then the child labor will get solved later, pointing out that in the industrialized world, in the United States, in Europe, child labor had to be solved in order for a prosperous middle class to emerge, and it was reform movements in the industrialized world and reform movements to eliminate child labor and pass child labor laws that had the effect of getting those kids into school where they could get an education and climb up and become middle class in our countries. We need to see that happen in the developing world as well. And investments in education are extremely important, and developed countries bear some responsibility for that. Ivory Coast, as an example, is a difficult example. Next door, Ghana is a bit of an easier example because it's a stable country where there have been investments in education. Ivory Coast has just had about 5 years of civil war. They're coming out of that. The government is very weak and very fragile, and we have seen on the ground the complete inability of the government to deliver education. You know, I don't want to say it's the government's fault, but I do think we all need to recognize the government's in a weak position and that there is a mismatch of expectations if we're expecting the Ivory Coast government, as it stands now, to simply step in, enforce laws, carry out programs, and provide children with education. I mention all this in part because that is precisely what the chocolate companies are claiming is the solution and have claimed now for 6 years. When this problem of child trafficking and forced child labor was first exposed in the international news media in 2001, the chocolate industry worldwide banded together and said, we don't need regulation, we don't need to be held accountable, we'll work with the governments, the regional governments, to take care of the problem voluntarily. And to this day, they continue to point the finger at the governments of West Africa, particularly the government of Ivory Coast, and to say, well, consumers are going to have to wait until the government of Ivory Coast manages to clean up its cocoa supply. It's not our responsibility. In fact, you know, as we've seen, it's the companies, the Cargills and the Nestles, that have much greater power in a place like Ivory Coast. So we are a bit troubled that they are now waiting for the Ivory Coast government to solve the problem, when we've seen the Ivory Coast government has a hard time even managing to provide upkeep for existing schools in the country.
Yes, it sounds like an exploitation of a situation of weak government. I'm wondering what we consumers can do, Bama. I mean, if you're confronted with a Nestlé product, how can you, you know, on the packaging, look at it and assess whether or not it's been fair traded, whether or not it's been produced with labour that is paid fair wages?
We do recommend that consumers look for the fair trade label. We recognize that it's still not widely applied, probably not applied by your favorite chocolate companies, but we do think that asking them for it makes a huge world of difference. It's something every consumer can do. By all means, keep eating chocolate. We're not trying to tell people not to eat chocolate. We're not trying to tell you to avoid any, you know, particular product. But if you have a favorite product and you're a loyal consumer, the companies are likely to respond to some pressure from you. Every single, you know, person can write to Nestle or Hershey or whatever your favorite Cadbury company is and ask them why they aren't providing fair trade certified cocoa in their products. And if they are, give them some credit for that. Fair trade isn't the only certification system out there, but we've looked at various alternatives for this industry. It is the one that it's active in both Ivory Coast and Ghana, so you're not having to take any revenue away from those countries. It's possible to get fair trade certified cocoa from Ivory Coast and from Ghana. And it would be very helpful to farmers in those countries to have more and more companies coming in and asking for that fair trade cocoa.
That was Bama Athreya, the Executive Director of International Labour Rights Forum. Bama, where can our friends who are listening go for further information?
Our website is www.laborrights.org, and we provide regular updates on our chocolate campaign.
Bama's joining us from Washington today. It's Sunday afternoon. Bama, thank you very much for giving up part of your Sunday afternoon to talk with us today.
Oh, Chris, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for inviting me.
De mala porque su reliquia le quieren cambiar. Primero fue con San Antonio Luis Enrique Maya. Ahora la cosa es distinta, le voy a contar. En la casa de Gregorio bien seguro estaba una reliquia del pueblo tipo colonial. Era una custodia linda, bien grande y pesada. Ahora por una liviana la quieren cambiar. Se la llevaron, se la llevaron. Se la llevaron, ya se perdió. Se la llevaron.
pasa es que la tiene un ratero honrado. Lo que ocurre es que un honrado se la robó. Lo que pasa es que la tiene un ratero honrado. Lo que ocurre es que un honrado se la robó. Aunque digan que es calumnia del pueblo de Vadillo, ellos con mucha razón presentaron su prueba. No tiene el mismo tamaño, no pesa lo mismo. No tiene el mismo color, entonces no es ella. Parece que el inspector como que tuvo miedo. Mucho miedo en ese caso para proceder. Porque todavía no ha dicho quién es el ratero. Aunque todo el pueblo sabe quién puede ser. Seguramente que no fui yo, ni Alfonso López ni Pedro K. Seguramente que no fui yo, ni Alfonso López ni Pedro K. Ahora no fue Enrique Maya quien se la robó. Ahora no podrán decir que fue un vallenato. Ahora no fue Enrique Maya quien se la robó. Ahora no podrán decir que fue un vallenato. A mi compa con la guerra cuando tenga fiesta, oiga que abra bien los ojos para vigilar. Como una 45 en la puerta de la iglesia, todo el que tenga sotana no lo deje entrar. Al terminar la misa que se pongan del cura para abajo a requisar. Al terminar la misa que se pongan del cura para abajo a requisar.
Was La Costadilla de Badillo from the CD Canta Bovia y su Vallenatos con Alberto Fernandez. Some sweet and saucy strains to go with chocolate, which is the theme of today's program. You're listening to Radio New Internationalist, coming to you through radios, computers and iPods around the world, like the one you're listening to now. And if you want to hear the perspectives of any of today's guests again, or you've missed the earlier parts of this program, just jump onto your computer and visit the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. Then click on Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, and today we're talking with Troth Wells about the book that she's co-written, The Bittersweet World of Chocolate, with 50 delicious recipes. Time for dessert, Troth. Give us your favourite.
Lots of choice. So there's Brazil nut and chocolate mousse, coffee with rum and chocolate. But I thought we'd go for something from Latin America again, and I've chosen Mexican chocolate drink. This is the Rolls Royce of hot chocolate, Chris. This is rich and creamy with an intriguing spicy note. Definitely not to be squandered on the unappreciative, so don't give it to the kids.
My taste, but my mouth is watering.
In fact, a similar drink is made in the Caribbean island of Grenada.
Our next guest is from Grenada.
Oh, good. Well, I heard that some people supposedly walk with a, quote, dancing step, which has come about from dancing cocoa down the generations. And this dancing refers to the way that the cocoa beans were polished by people walking or dancing over them. This recipe uses milk and cream. And you sort of heat that in a bowl over some hot water. And then you add cinnamon and nutmeg, which is grown in Grenada, and allspice. And you simmer that for about 10 minutes. And then in a separate pan, you gently heat the cooking chocolate with a bit of water till it melts. You take that from the heat, built in two egg yolks, whisk in the spice milk, and then it all sort of thickens and gets really, really rich and gorgeous. And you drink it straight away.
You have a very lucky family. You know, they must really like the work you're doing at the moment.
Oh, yes. They love it when there's chocolate mentioned, except the dog, because chocolate is dangerous for dogs. So my dog, who normally licks up and eats any scraps that fall her way, she has to be quite careful about that one.
And why is that, Troth?
Oh, it's the drugs in chocolate. Theobromine and caffeine are toxic to pets.
Well, certainly not poisonous to us, Troth. Thank you so much for bringing in such yummy morsels into today's program. That was Troth Wells, a co-editor of New Internationalist magazine, and she was talking about the book she's co-written, The Bittersweet World of Chocolate, with 50 delicious recipes. And if you want to find out more, just go to the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. Troth, you're a champion. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Chris.
While we in the rich world can enjoy the wonderful desserts that Troth has just been talking about, there's little that's just about chocolate desserts. The average family in the United States and Australia spends more on chocolate in a year than the average cocoa farmer earns. That's where fair trade comes in. Fair trade chocolate is made from cocoa for which a fair price has been paid. The Granada Chocolate Company in the Caribbean takes this fair trade concept a number of steps further by allowing farmers to participate in making the chocolate their cocoa bean go into. Mott Green is a founding director with the company. How does it work, Mott?
Well, this project was started indeed because after living in Grenada for some years doing other things, I noticed that the price that cocoa farmers receive for cocoa is very low compared to the price of manufactured chocolate. And I tend to be a purist in spirit, and I wanted to find a very ideal way to create a chocolate company that would approach this problem. And I figured that the best approach would be to make chocolate right in Grenada, because I decided to try to revolutionize the connection between cocoa farming and the sale of finished chocolate bars by actually making those chocolate bars right in Grenada with farmers and the local community.
So essentially you're allowing farmers then to participate in the value added to chocolate across the supply chain, not only in the actual sale of the cocoa beans, but then what's done with them in terms of the manufacturing process and then the distribution chain as well. Is that essentially it, Matt?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Grenada is a small community, and our little chocolate company cooperative is run and owned by all Grenadians, aside from myself. I'm sort of an honorary Grenadian, having been here for 20 years. And all of the money that comes into this project stays in Grenada. And, you know, it has a lot of interesting advantages. By working directly with cocoa farmers here and having cocoa farmers as shareholders of the project, it absolutely assures that the profitability of our company is shared among cocoa farmers. It allows all the cocoa farmers involved to be reimbursed at the time that they harvest their cocoa at a very, very high rate. And it also has some nice gastronomic advantages. For example, cocoa is fermented always on the farm where it's produced. And since our chocolate factory is right on and around our organic cocoa farms, it allows us to do our own fermenting. So that creates more job, and it also allows us to actually tweak our fermentation process to make the chocolate taste as good as possible, which is an advantage that almost no other chocolate makers really have.
So tell us about Grenada and the position of chocolate farmers within it. What's the economy like, and where does chocolate making fit within the economy?
Grenada traditionally, until really the last 10, 20 years or so, has been an agricultural island with its main industry, nutmeg and cocoa beans and bananas. And over the last 20 years, agriculture has declined so extremely, which is, I think, typical of small countries, particularly in this part of the world, perhaps everywhere, as a result of globalization. Cocoa has been in great decline for about 20 years, and the fact that cocoa farmers weren't getting paid very much for their cocoa beans really prevented cocoa farmers from being able to make ends meet. And when I started this project, Grenada's cocoa was largely abandoned. Grenada was exporting, still is exporting, a small fraction of the amount of cocoa that they used to export. Before the onset of tourism here, before many Grenadians have traveled to different parts of the world and found other careers to keep this economy in Grenada going. So cocoa has been kind of on the back burner and largely forgotten, and it's a great irony in a place like Grenada. I understand it's fairly similar in Venezuela and Trinidad, for example, other countries near here, because places like Grenada have some of the best tasting cocoa in the world, very famous for it, and the price that the government sells the cocoa for is relatively high, but the cost of chocolate bars, even fancy chocolate bars on the world market in different rich countries, is artificially low because it's really based on a price for cocoa beans that does not allow farmers to really have enough money to pay a good agricultural rate for their labor. So agricultural labor has always been kind of the lowest on the totem pole, salary-wise. And as countries like Grenada become slightly better off because of tourism and travel, agricultural work becomes highly stigmatized for good reasons. You know, the sad past of these islands that were originally slave islands, and then all the exploitation since then. So we really need to reverse this trend. And one way is by producing chocolate right here, of course, so that the farmers have a big piece of the pie. And we're very fortunate in Grenada to have such good cocoa. And we're also very lucky that the world appears to be much more socially conscious, wants to be more responsible. There's big movements towards fair trade and so on. So we can sell our chocolate for a high price because it tastes so good and because people want to support the company. And unlike the fair trade certified companies of the world, all of the money after expenses, or I should say except for the few things that we import, like packaging material and organic sugar, all of the expenses go into the Grenadian economy. I mean, even the electricity that we use goes to the Grenadian Electric Company, which is run and owned by Grenadians.
You were talking before, Mott, about slavery. Were slaves used to harvest cocoa beans in Grenada before?
Yes. The first maybe century of cocoa growing was still during the slavery period. Most of the slavery associated with the Caribbean islands was sugar cane, of course.
Absolutely.
And cocoa and nutmeg came along a bit later.
And what about the decline of cocoa bean production across Latin America? I mean, chocolate is something that originated in Latin America, and now 95% of cocoa bean is grown in Africa and Asia. Why has there been a decline in that crop? Is it all because of the factors that you were talking about before, about agriculture being on the decline and not earning enough for the farmers?
Yes. Now, when you look at that statistic, it's also that even when cocoa was not in decline in this part of the world, it still became the great small fraction of the amount of cocoa produced in the world simply because there's only so much room to grow cocoa in this part of the world. And when they took the varieties that would work to Africa and Asia, there was much more room to plant cocoa. And that was the way that so much cocoa ended up getting produced in the world to produce so much chocolate. Now, the interesting thing, and it's a great irony, is that the varieties that were taken away from this part of the world, the Americas to Africa, are not the best varieties. And they are known as bulk cocoa. And they have a very pure chocolate flavor, but rather dull, without what they call the flavor notes and different interesting flavors that the kind of cocoa in this part of the world has, called fine flavored cocoa. But what's interesting is that I believe we're going to see drastic changes in the next few years. I believe we're going to see a revitalization of the cocoa in this part of the world, because parts of the world like the United States and the UK and Australia and even China, so many places, are starting to get an appreciation for what they call gastronomic chocolate, you know, comparable to fine wine that's very expensive and tastes very special. Whereas in the past, it was really only continental Europe with a much smaller market that appreciated this chocolate. Chocolate companies that make these fine chocolates absolutely need a certain percentage of fine flavored cocoa from this part of the world here in the Americas to mix in to their chocolate bars in order for the chocolate to taste special enough. Now, this new trend of fine chocolate becoming popular in the larger markets is so new that I don't think the shortage has been felt just yet, but I believe what's going to happen is in the next few years, the world is going to feel a shortage. The chocolate company is trying to meet the market for all these people that want very, very special tasting chocolate are going to find that there's a shortage, and one way or another they're going to push production again.
Sorry to interrupt you there, Mott. What are we talking about the difference between bulk chocolate and, as you say, the fine notes in the types of chocolate that you're producing at the moment?
Bulk chocolate has what they call a lot of perceived chocolate flavor, which is your kind of basic chocolate cake brownie flavor with a very small amount of natural acid missing these certain flavor notes. Flavor notes are very much like wine, hints of other flavors, citrus flavors and other fruit flavors and flowery flavors, and this general acidic, lovely quality that the bulk cocoa just doesn't have. And fine flavored cocoa, especially in a place like Grenada, with such rich volcanic soil, also has a more deep, robust chocolate flavor. So the bulk cocoa, that's the vast majority of the cocoa in the world, lends itself to milk chocolate and to cooked goods, baked goods, like cookies and brownies and cakes and so on. And the fact that there's so much of this bulk chocolate and so little of the fine flavored cocoa really is related to why milk chocolate has become ubiquitous and most of the world has grown on low quality chocolate.
Yes. I'm looking at the figures for 2002 and 2003 in terms of percentage increase of fair trade cocoa sales into various countries. And the percentage increases are enormous. For instance, Belgium, over 2,000% increase from 2002 to 2003 in fair traded cocoa. France, nearly 600%. Italy, over 100%. And the US, a whopping 4,290% increase in its demand for fair traded chocolate between 2002 and 2003. What do you put this trend down to? Is the world waking up? Does it want organic chocolate because it doesn't want GM, it doesn't want pesticides on its cocoa, or is it about fair trade?
There's a distinction, of course. Fair trade and organic are different things. The so-called fair trade certified companies are organic. In other cases, there aren't. I think both is going on, though. I think that the organic movement is the bigger of the two. I think that it's clear that in the last few years, parts of the world are really waking up to a kind of health consciousness, the rise of cancer and disease, the awareness of chemicals in food is become a very, very big thing. And that's why the organic market is, I believe, one of the fastest growing markets in all food. Now, the fair trade issue is a separate thing, and it's also getting more popular. And I think that's due to perhaps, maybe it's overly optimistic, but it appears that maybe there's a general sense of consciousness about buying responsibility and where food comes from and exploitation. And I think that there's been a lot of things exposed that's been very helpful. For example, child slave labor, forced labor, and things like that.
So what's in it for the farmers? What type of income are they earning relative to the rest of people in Grenada?
Well, the typical agricultural laborers in Grenada probably making, you know, I would say between a half and three quarters of the salary compared to other jobs, you know, office jobs and
wow.
jobs in the tourism
sector. Yeah, that's
sector.
Really low, isn't it?
The thing is, it's very strange in Grenada because unemployment is massive. I mean, it's very crazy and ironic that the governments of countries like Grenada would let agriculture slip away because it really is necessary for the economy. The unemployment is huge here. I think that there are only official jobs for, I don't know, as little as 20 or 30% of Grenadians in these other sectors. You know, Grenada is a very small country and education is very good here and people tend to be very clever. So the trend has really been for Grenadians to get well educated and then move away from Grenada. And there are more Grenadians living in New York City and in London and in Canada and scattered other places than there are in Grenada by far. And I think what's happened is there's kind of an artificial economy in Grenada. It's quite interesting because Grenadians are very patriotic and they tend to stick with their country when they're living abroad and send back money and eventually move back and build houses. So it's as though the country's kind of inadvertently accepted this and allowed agriculture to become this stigmatized. And what we really need and what we're hoping this chocolate project will create, at least in the cocoa crops, is just a radical, abrupt change, a much higher salary for agricultural labor, and a sense of pride, I think, is important too, that people are getting paid to grow cocoa that's making Grenada famous for chocolate.
So in terms of the fair trade of chocolate, what barriers are you finding in sales at the moment into the rich world?
The good news for us, actually, is that we are not finding any barriers. We command a fairly high price, and the demand has exceeded our very small production, actually, for years now. So we're very, very lucky. We don't have to worry too much about persuading the world to buy our chocolate. We just have to follow through and get more farms organically certified here and grow our processing end of the company and just simply make more chocolate. I would just say in summary that I would encourage consumers to research who's making the chocolate that they're eating and where the cocoa beans are coming from. And what I would like to see is people just taking more responsibility researching these details and not necessarily simply looking at a chocolate bar and saying, well, it says fair trade certified, so that means I'm doing the right thing.
That was Mott Green, who is a founding director with the Grenada Chocolate Company in the Caribbean. Mott, if people would like to order some of your wonderful sounding chocolate, where would they go?
For the moment, if you go to GrenadaChocolate.com, you can order online from our UK web distributor, who will, in theory, send chocolate anywhere in the world. At this point, it tends to be quite expensive, the shipping and everything, in small scale. Over the next year or so, I encourage people to check back with GrenadaChocolate.com and look for a link that I'm going to create soon to a website that's going to be all about cooperative efforts to create all different kinds of cocoa products.
It's a delicious project in so many ways, Mott. Thank you very much for sharing it with us tonight.
Thank you very much for allowing me to.
The music that we've been playing tonight comes from the Riverboat Records series in the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. Today's CD is called Canta Bovia y su Bayanatos con Alberto Fernandez, celebrating that Colombian style of music called Vallenato. It's usually accordion-led, and I reckon proves that not nearly enough credit is being given to the accordion's sweet and saucy strains. Find out more on the World Music Network's website, www.worldmusic.net, or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org, which is also where you'll find a copy of this program just waiting for you to download from our audio archives. And iPodders, if you want to subscribe to the program, the New Internationalist website is where it's at. That address again, www.newint.org. Radio New Internationalist is produced at 3CR in Melbourne, Australia, and distributed via satellite on the Community Radio Network. Thanks to the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial assistance and the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia for sending this program to a wireless near you. This program's associate producer is Rachel Marr. I'm Chris Richards. Talk to you soon.